1A and 60 watt output with the, I believe it's a about a 6 or 8 dB gain antenna, but I have a hard time reaching your repeater, but sometimes it comes in just fine. I'm up here in Waterbury, Connecticut.
Yeah, the question is what's the problem? I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Well, the question is, I don't know, my end is about 60, and I have an Omni antenna. Do you think I would need more power reaching you guys on a more consistent basis to contribute or work with you guys when you have the net?
Well, assuming, as you mentioned, that there are times that the propagation conditions don't work out and you can't capture the repeater, you'd have to somehow get more signal in the direction of the repeater, either by a different antenna with a better directional gain or a booster to the power output. I remember once I had an awful antenna, and I decided I was going to cheat Mother Nature, and I bought a Mirage amplifier and boosted the handy talkie from 5 watts to about 105 or 110 watts. And because my antenna was so awful, it didn't have any beneficial effects. Right now, I have an RM Italy amplifier hooked in series. If I need to boost my signal, I cut it in and deal with the thermal issues. But yeah, I would think that either a directional Yagi antenna or throwing more watts of power out.
Yeah, affirmative on the more watts. The yeah, I was thinking about the Yagi. I have a switch that goes back and forth. But, like I said, sometimes you guys, the repeater comes in so clear, and then earlier this evening, I heard you say all you were getting was a signal, static signal from my transmitter.
Oh, okay, you were the guy with the, yeah, it was all noise. It was 100% noise. I could not make out that it was a person. Someone wanted to make a comment there?
Roger, KD2RMD. I'm impressed he's even making the repeater. I'm looking at, but Waterbury is deep into Connecticut. It's not on the coastline. And as he's talking, I'm receiving here at a 5.9 plus 20, so he's actually hitting it quite what he's doing. I'm going to give him a kudos for what he's doing. So I don't think he needs to make a change. The fact that he's even hitting it is quite impressive, KD2RMD.
Yeah, the station that just responded, at 60 watt output, and my antenna is really not that high. It's mounted on my chimney, and like I said, it's an omnidirectional antenna. I believe advertised about 60 dB.
Yeah, Russell, I appreciate what you're saying, but it sounds as though he has, you know, sometimes it gets to the repeater, but sometimes it doesn't. Earlier tonight, even though it was a very good signal for the distance, it wasn't enough to even partial quiet the repeater. So again, although he's doing great for where he is, he probably, if he wants consistent ability to tag the repeater, he's going to need a little bit more power.
And Waterbury has a little bit high altitude.
A better hit on the repeater, he would have to upgrade to a directional beam antenna. I just don't see any other option. A directional beam antenna, and then he would be hitting it like gangbusters.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was talking about, Yagi. But yeah, you know, I mean, probably if everything was equally problematic, antennas usually are the best solution for almost any problem. Again, I tried in the past to solve it with slapping an amplifier, and because my antenna was just so awful, it didn't really help. But you know, in a perfect universe, I'd say, yeah, get a very high gain, directional Yagi, and to the repeater, and then you have to work too much about power output. Not a perfect world, so probably if you could get a second-hand amplifier and put it in, I think like a couple different gadgets. Just have somebody off. I don't know if from Connecticut, we have people who listen to us from Connecticut, and occasionally we have people who are members of LIMARC who set up their equipment specifically so that they could reach our repeater. Like I said before, I've had people even in Brooklyn where they tell me I really should get a Yagi. Just to be absolutely positively sure that I could hit the Glen Oaks repeater. I think it's a wee bit of overkill. In the old days, I could tag the repeater with about 5 watts of power. But a Yagi certainly would help. Again, it depends what's easier for you. If it's easier to just kind of write a check and put a, something, I don't know, like an RM Italy, it's 250, it gets you around 180 watts. Or if it's easier to put up a Yagi with a nice rotator.
Yeah, affirmative on the Yagi. I believe I would rather go with the antenna route. And I just wouldn't know, or really don't know what power DB gain I should be looking at with the Yagi.
AC1SAM is in Connecticut.
Yes, that is true. I forgot about KC1SAM. He's a regular on the repeater from Connecticut, but he has magic trees.
Does, and one of those magic trees is now holding one of his antennas about 20 feet higher than before. So they are magical trees.
Okay, very good. Glad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, the secret with SAM KC1SAM is that the tree in his, the antenna in his magical tree is a directional Yagi that he's able to position and orient so that its front face is pointing in the general direction of the repeater, so most of the gain is going there. But, I don't know what to tell you about how much gain is enough. It really depends upon the environment and elevation and obstructions and all kinds of things. I mean, ultimately, sort of the better gain that you get, all things being equal, the safer you are. But that doesn't mean that I would suggest that you try an array like Dick K2RIW had on his QSL cards. He had an array of, actually, they were UHF Yagis, an enormous array of them. But it certainly would be better than a vertical. You'll get much more gain out of a directional Yagi than you will an omnidirectional vertical.
Affirmative on the antenna. Well, once again, they're not that expensive as far as the antenna is concerned. Switching system wouldn't be that bad. I would rather do the antenna. And basically, I listen to your repeater, especially on Sunday nights for the technical information. So I'm going to give that shot and order one up and go from there. But I really appreciate listening to you guys. So thank you very much, and hopefully next time I talk to you guys, I'll have something to say with the new antenna. Again, my name's Greg, and it's N1TOP.
KC1SAM.
Yes, Sam of the Magic Trees. What do you have to say?
I just took, and to my surprise, I heard someone talking about my trees. What can I do for anybody?
No, Greg is a fellow Connecticutite. He has a vertical omnidirectional with, he believes, somewhere around 6 to 8 decibels of gain. He has a 60-watt transmitter, and there are some times that he simply can't trigger the repeater or at least quiet it down. So he was asking of his options. We were talking about amplifiers. We were talking about directional Yagis. I think he's decided to give directional Yagis a chance. If you have some recommendations for one of those, please feel free.
KC1SAM. The good ones I know of, M Square. I have two. I have a 12-element 2-meter and a 18-element 440. The 18-element 440 lets me talk to the repeater in the plane. And, of course, I don't really need the other one. I got it, but my verticals are so high. You know, it's hard to get a Yagi up really high in a tree. But the verticals, I can go up 100 feet, 110 feet, no problem. The tree sit. So the height actually makes more of a difference than the Yagi when it comes to 2 meters. So the three magic words, height.
Yes, indeed, Sam. Elevation, and elevation. What's the specs gain for your VHF, Yagi?
15 dB gain. But the trouble is, it's big, and I can't get it up more than, what is it now, maybe 50 feet, 56 feet. And it's such a long distance. I don't need it to talk to Selvin. What I was trying to do with it was get direct to Glen Oaks all the time, which is in Tibetan from up here. But it's just not high enough and not powerful enough to give me Glen Oaks all the time.
Okay, very good, Sam. Thank you for putting in your experiences. M Square is a very good manufacturer of antennas. I've read a lot of great things about them. They're very sturdy. They're very well built. You don't have to scrounge extra screws and nuts, as far as I'm aware. So it's a very good brand name. You pay, you pay what you get for, and so you know it's not cheap. But I think they're good quality products.
Yeah, N1POB here. My location is 800 feet above the sea level, right up the Naugatuck Valley. So that's probably why I'm doing a decent job, but not as good as I would like.
Yep. Is that the average height, or is that your height? Are you in the area?
I was asking where the Connecticut station is located.
N1POP. My station is located at 800 feet to the east of the valley, the Naugatuck Valley, which is down around about 250 foot on average above sea level, where the Naugatuck River flows down into Bridgeport. And so my elevation is pretty high compared to where you guys are down near sea level.
I can ask, what are you using now for an antenna?
Aero, and I really, is it a Model 50, I believe? Is that an Aero model?
I don't know, but you're being successful. And it's, I'm more than willing to, I don't want to tie up the tech net, more than willing to help you out. My QRZ page, you can see my setup. And if you want any tips or anything, I'm more than happy to get into you at some point. At some point, we'll have to chat.
Oh, absolutely. I really appreciate that. Like I said, I enjoy this net. A lot of good information. And I can hear most of the time of the transmission from the repeater, just that I can't make it to the repeater on a good solid basis. N1POP.
What repeaters do you use over there? And then I'll get off out of the way here, because I can hit repeaters up in that area, no problem at all.
Yeah, coming back here. The prospect repeater is about 2 miles from my house. I can hit that with just about anything.
What's the frequency?
Yeah, 146835.
Yeah, I'm looking. I didn't write that one down. I don't know if I hit that one. But I hear repeaters up that way all the time. There's other ones in Prospect, too. 147, 180, and a couple. Anyway, let me not tie up the TechNet. You're going to be up for a while. Descends around 11. I'll probably be still up.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have a hard time actually getting to sleep, so I'm a night bird and one POP.
Catch you at 11, KC1SAM, back for tying up in that. But I was surprised when I heard you. Anyway, back over to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Sam. Thank you, Greg, for checking in. And please, when you get the Yagi hooked up, come back and tell us how it's working for you. So once again, this is AC2GS. I am Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Paul's space report is imminent. I did mention that I wanted to say a couple little things about coronavirus and ask if there are any simple short questions that I could answer. You know probably better than I. The United States has seen over 90,000 deaths so far. There's over 1.5 million reported cases. This is probably a lowball figure because a lot of people were asymptomatic or weren't able to be tested, and so it's probably a lot more than that. Thankfully, New York City is much better than it has been in a while. Admissions are down. Admissions are down. A lot of places in the country, everything's going down. But unfortunately, there are some parts of the country where things are staying high or going a little bit higher. And everyone seems to be dropping the social distancing, so I don't know what's going to happen in 2-3 weeks. The problem with this infection is the cause and effect isn't immediately linked. It takes a good 3-4 weeks to see what changes you've put into the system and how they came out. So we'll be optimistic, but please continue socially distancing and listen to the public health officials and be safe and don't be panicking, but don't be indifferent to it. If anyone has any short questions on the coronavirus tonight that they would like to ask, this is as good a time as any before the space report.
KD2, FIU.
Yes, George.
The way I understand it right now, the virus is not going away. We're just ducking it, and we're doing a good job.
Yes, George, I would agree with you. Unfortunately, we're playing for time, which is a good thing if you're doing something else at the same time. If you have a time machine, you can go about a year in the future and get a few billion vials of effective vaccine. That would be real nifty. But without that time machine, even the most optimistic people are suggesting that it's going to be a while. First, they have to test its safety. Then they have to test its efficacy, that it's effective, that it's significantly effective, that they can produce billions of it and spread it around the world to vaccinate everyone, and hopefully that a single vaccine will suffice, that the virus doesn't morph like influenza does, or its immunity doesn't wane after a certain number of years some other viruses do.
Yeah, Roy, thank you for picking me up there. As long as we don't resort to Soylent Green, And I'll leave it over to you. 7-3, thank you for picking me up. KD2FIU.
2-1.
You're welcome, George. There's someone who's kind of getting in and out of the repeater, so I didn't hear their entire transmission.
It's Rich. I just wanted to say, for those who don't know, that our net control operator, Roy, is Dr. Roy, M.D. I don't know if everybody knows that, but the guy answering these medical questions is, in fact, a physician. WTBC.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate that. In the old days, dear Dick used to introduce me as Dr. Roy. I don't usually, that's probably because when John, who used to be in this technical net, that's the way he used to call me, Dr. Roy, when the two of them would mention me on the technical net. So I usually don't use that honorific on the technical net, but yes, I am a practicing licensed physician for 40-odd years. It's not like I just read the medical papers last Wednesday. Anyone else with any questions before I turn it over to Paul?
W2HO.
Yes, Howard.
Okay, Roy. I was listening to a report that a vaccine, I know they're trying to warp speed a vaccine, and I heard a report that I believe Oxford University is close, and another company, there's a lot of companies out there. I hear Israel is close. But I believe that one company, I think it was Oxford, where they inoculated, they tried the vaccine, they're trying it out, they have it, and they tried the vaccine out on two primates, monkeys. One, they gave the vaccine to one of them. One, they did not give the vaccine and exposed them to the virus. One that was not inoculated with pneumonia. The one with the vaccine didn't get any symptoms at all. I know primates are close to us in DNA, but what's your opinion on that as a physician? If something works on primates, does that mean that there's a very good chance that it will work with us? Back to you, Roy.
Well, in principle, Howard, it's a very good sign because monkeys are very close genetically to us, and so the chances of something working for them is pretty good that it'll work for us. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, it was a very limited study. It was two individuals, two monkeys. You would need to have much more, much larger numbers. You would need to do a lot of. Definitely is going to have to go through the stages of scaling, be able to discern the degree of the response, whether it was really significant, whether it was long-lasting. If you find a vaccine that gives you wonderful immunity for 30 to 60 days, that's almost worthless because we can't vaccinate people every 2 months or something. So there's a lot of hoops that need to be jumped through. The Oxford lab initially used their studies that were based on the previous SARS virus and tweaked the vaccination to fit more closely the coronavirus. And according to their report, they've gotten pharmaceutical labs to gear up production that they'll have as much as 1 million vials of this stuff in January if it proves to be safe and effective. But even 1 million vials of it wouldn't even vaccinate a significant number of people in Great Britain who you think would have first dibs on it than us. We're going to need billions of vials of this stuff in order to inoculate the world against it. So I'm optimistic by that, and there are 100 vaccination studies going on simultaneously. And I'm very hopeful that at least a few of them will be found to be safe and effective. I don't know exactly how quickly they will be able to scale up to the hundreds of millions of vaccinations necessary. And there are still these anti-vax people out there who haven't had an opportunity to yell and scream about vaccination. That's going to be a problem as well.
Yeah, Roger. Thank you, Roy. Very well put. And thanks for the information. I appreciate it. Everybody else, I'm sure, does. And have a good night. Back to you there, Roy, W2HO.
Well, thank you, Howard. And once again, to remind everyone, May 29th, that's not this Friday, but the Friday after next at 9 p.m., we are going to have an all-nighter, what I call a radio wake in memory of a great man, Dick, K2RIW, who moderated the technical net for 38 long years and did a wonderful job of it. We all have great memories of him, so I'm looking forward to that. So pencil it into your calendar, May 29th at 9 p.m., on this repeater. Also, once again, if you have any mailbag questions or topics you want me to cover or puzzles or science reports or what have you, or you want me to tell Paul about a website or a story that he should look into, you can reach me by emailing me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Usually I mention my link page, but I haven't really covered any stories, so there's probably nothing to put on the link page for tonight. But I do, as always, want to thank everyone who participated in my portion of the technical net. And now I would like to bring on Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good. Right. On all of that, and if you needed more time for the coronavirus, of course, that's a priority. The space report, we could always delay from week to week if we had to. Coronavirus is it's a life and death situation, so no problem there. As long as it's going on, you could always do that. Have no fear. This morning, there was a rocket that took off. I got to watch on one of the websites that I go to, and it was an Atlas V. It was supposed to go up yesterday morning, but it was delayed due to weather. Launch from Florida, Launch Complex 41, and that's launched by the United Launch Alliance, the UAL. And then what that is a consortium of Lockheed and Boeing, and they put that rocket together, and it's so far 100% effective. It's been launched, like, I guess, 10 years now, and that will eventually be launching people on the Starliner, the Boeing Starliner. Well, it went up this morning, and it was carrying the X-37B, which I've mentioned here before, and it took off successfully this morning instead of yesterday. And what the X-37B is, it's a space plane, really. It's on top of a rocket carrying 30. Looks like a small shuttle, you know. It even has cargo bays that open up, and, you know, it deploys different experiments. It's unmanned. It flies in space. It's on wheels. And, you know, originally it started going up in 2010, right before the last shuttle was actually launched. And it's been going up ever since. But each time it goes up, it goes on these extended missions. You know, the first one was like, you know, 500 days, and 800 days, and so on. I think we got to 780 days on the last flight. And this is the sixth time that it's flown. So the X-37B went up today and will probably come back in a couple of years. But it's a DARPA. It started off as a DARPA or a defense. It's up for NASA. But they still keep the flight secret. After it goes up a couple of minutes, they cut off the broadcast. Supposedly you don't know where it goes, but you have amateurs on the ground with telescopes, and they can see this thing, and they know real what station's on and roughly the altitude. And changes locations in space. It has regular thrusters, but it also has an ion thruster on board too, a Hall effect ion thruster, so it could change locations quite easily in space over time. But on this, it's an experiment to collect solar energy, so the big solar panel comes out. And the idea is to eventually beam it back to Earth. But, you know, this is only, you know, step one, so they're going to be happy to collect the solar energy, naturally it's DC. And instead of, you know, transmitting on an antenna, we're going to bring it up to 2.4 gigahertz in that area, so in a microwave band. And instead of transmitting it, they're actually going to transmit it down a cable and into a receiver of sort, and they're going to be able to tell how many watts are going into the solar panel and how many watts are transmitted down the cable. And then they're going to figure out the efficiency of it. And over time, they're going to try to tweak it and get better efficiency. Long-term goal is to use this... the ultimate goal, of course, to put big solar panels in space and maybe beam it down to Earth. But on a temporary basis, they really would rather use this also in the military, for instance. You send up a drone operated on electricity instead of gas. The military could send one up and it would have solar panels on the drone. And if you could beam a signal, power to that drone, you can keep that thing flying indefinitely. Right now it goes up for batteries quick, back down. The military would love nothing. All of this thing. In fact, just for that reason. I think to them, that's important. Long term, they plan on putting up solar panels, bringing it down to Earth. But, I'm not going to hold my breath for that. But I could see in the field, maybe they need to beam some power, from one hill to another instead of running cables, for a short period of time. I could see them doing that. About a year ago, they had an experiment at the Naval Research Lab in Maryland. And they set up, it's a building, a very long building. I think it was a couple of thousand feet long. And they set up a transmitter and a receiver, not microwave, but laser, infrared laser. You couldn't really see it. It was there. But it was up about 13 feet above the ground, and they had another receiver about 13 feet down, 13 feet in the air. And thousands of people show up, they're interested in this, so set it up, and transmit 2,000 watts out of one end, and on a receiver, they had photocells that were sensitive to infrared light, and they took that and converted it to power, and they were getting 400 watts out of it on the other end, enough to, they converted that to usable AC, and they ran a couple of laptop computers, and they plugged in a coffee maker, and they were actually making coffee for the demonstration and a couple of little, you know, electronic gizmos that they hooked up to it. So that was a pretty good experiment. And I thought about the safety of it, you know, and hundreds of people in, along this, it looked like a long row of people. I saw a picture of it. And they couldn't physically see the beam. The only way they could see the beam going from the transmitter to the receiver was by looking at a monitor. And the monitor was, you know, set up with an infrared set of cameras to be able to see the beam going from one end to the other. But the idea of the safety of it, what they have is, you know, superimposed on it, you know, probably microwave or something. You know, they really didn't say, but there's another signal, you know, a safe signal that's also being transmitted. So if somebody was to go near this thing, even a bird or something, was to go near it, it would automatically shut off, and you wouldn't get zapped by the laser. And then before it comes on, superimposed signal is, you know, is also transmitted. So if there's something in the way, the beam won't come back on. So if that person moves, that bird flies out of the way, the transmitter would come back on. So I thought that was pretty interesting. That was last year. But this is an extension of that, and of course, changing it from infrared to microwave to 2.4 gig. So that X-37B space plane is up there, and I guess over time I'll be able to report on how they did. This is WS2N. Any comments or questions? Okay, just to change the topic, last Wednesday the club had a meeting, and a virtual meeting, so people who check in, and what they did was very well done. You know, they have regular meetings, but then they have presentation, and there's this one fellow, his name was Frank, I wrote his call down here somewhere, WA2NDV. He gave a presentation all about satellites, you know, working satellites. Perfect. Program satellites about the best place to go to get all the information on what satellites are up there. There's dozens of these awesome. Orbiting satellites, been doing it since the 60s, and different things amateur satellite that has now been put into operation. Not sure where they went, but nevertheless, this one particular satellite was sent up on a Cygnus spacecraft to launch cargo that's launched by the orbital. Cygnus is sitting there, and they unload everything, and out of all the stuff that they pull out. I mean, they pull out, you know, everything, spare parts for spacesuits, food, clothes, and science that have to be pulled into the station. And one of the things that this amateur radio satellite will launch it at a space, and they use it, you know, would do sometimes, you know, they'd have a small airlock, they could do it, but every time they use up a lot of oxygen, and a couple of times a year. So to make use of the Cygnus spacecraft, this amateur satellite sits on board the space station the whole time since it's attached to it. And eventually months go by and it's time to go up in the Cygnus. What they do is they take all the trash and garbage and they put it into Cygnus, because the ultimate goal is to burn Cygnus up over the South Pacific. So they came up with this great idea, and they've done this a couple of times now. Is they take this satellite out, and it's been sitting in the space station, and then they have this launcher that's also that comes out of Cygnus. When they close the door, they close the door 53, and where it was, they close one door. What they the inside door on the space station, this launcher, and they, in this case, the amateur radio satellite, they put it into this launcher, and attach it to the exterior part. So, of the space, module. So they close that door, and then they're able to send Cygnus on its way. They have these 16 bolts, that are undone with motors, and the thing is. One of the jobs, Cygnus has some other work that it's going to do for NASA, but one of its jobs is to launch the satellite, and that's what they did, and they did that the other day, and it's successfully turned on. It's got a solar panel, and it also has a small ion on top of it, the thruster that's attached to it, so it has maneuverability, and it's on. So I guess you could look up AOS. I don't have any. You could look up Oscar Satellite 7, and you see free. I know I have that on. And that's the story. Any questions?
KD2FYU. Paul, it's George.
How you doing, George? Back over to you.
I'm well, thank you. And I'm intrigued by what you started mentioning 2 weeks ago about how the debris is being retrieved out of space. That's really something that is a tremendous effort and is also necessary. And maybe one of the nets in the future, you can give us a little briefing on OSCAR. I'm familiar with it. It's got to be close to 30 years old now, availability for amateur radios. And I know Yaesu made some really nice specific radios to work OSCAR in the late 1990s, but thank you for giving the update on new devices, bringing the debris up, and over to you, Paul.
I've only met a couple of guys. I did Oscar 15 in maybe the early 90s. That was one of these things where you transmitted on, it was done on HF radio, you transmitted on 10 meters, I think. I had a two-element 10-meter homebrew beam at the time, and you transmit on that, and I think it was coming back down on 15 meters. So yeah, I have A and B on, the two frequencies in on the Kenwood 440 HF rig, and I was able to transmit up on one and come back on that on the other. But that was a long time ago. Now they have all these different, they must have. They're up to 107, so some of them don't last long, and some of them stay up there longer. I think this one's going to stay up there longer. It's got an ion engine and a solar panel. Some of them are just like Dove satellites. Some of them are just like beacons. They just transmit. You can't even transmit up to them. But, so I don't have that much experience with it, but this fellow, Frank, WA2NDV, surely does, and he was terrific with his presentation last week. And like I said, you can see the whole presentation. It must go on for about a half hour or so. And if you go to linemark.org, and you'll see it, you click on it, you can watch this thing. And he'll tell you all about the satellite, much more than I could ever even think about. he's working them, and he's really into working the satellites. So, very good. Any other comments or questions?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
How you doing, Rich? Over to you, WS2N.
Just wondering how much activity is there on the on the satellite? Is it a very active thing, or does it sound more like 2 meters?
Well, he said there's a lot of people on his work. Computer programs and thoughts that he knows when the satellite's coming over. Other people know when the satellites are coming over. And he's able to do this on a regular basis. Naturally, you're not doing it all the time. Pop up Bob
activity there is on it, and if it's worth it to put all the time, effort, and money into learning how to do it, and then find out that the band is dead type of thing. So that's it. Back to you. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. They're calling it Husky Sat. Husky Sat. Husky Sat 1. And the transponders are set up. There's pass bands. It's 145.910 to 145.940 as an uplink. So you're transmitting on 2 meters, and you're receiving on 70 centimeters. It's coming down between 435.810. And 435.840. And they also have a 1200 board telemetry beacon that's also coming down. So I guess you can tune in on the beacon. You're hearing it at least, and that would be on 435.800 megahertz. So that's I did find the frequency, and they're calling it Husky Sat 1. It has to do with the people that made it. Let me drop it. another launch is going up this this week, and that'll be actually 2 days from now, on a Tuesday, in the middle of the night, but I'm not going to be up for that one, but you could see that one live as well. 3:15 a.m. on a Falcon 9 rocket by SpaceX, and they'll be launching from Launch Complex 40 down in Florida, and they'll be launching another 60 satellites. They do this on a regular basis. I believe this is the seventh time that they've done it. So each time they do it, they put up another 60 satellites, and this time I guess they'll be up to a total of five, 560 satellites for their broadband. I think when he gets up to around 1,000 or 1,200 or so, he's going to be able to have enough to do to actually start selling, to customers to be able to work the. Work this broadband, they call it a Starlink system. Each satellite is like 500 pounds, and, you know, it's pretty big. When you put 60 satellites on one launch vehicle, you're looking at, 30,000 pounds. But it's pretty cool to watch these. I've seen him many, many times. He launches the rocket. The booster separates. It launches on 9 Merlin D rocket engines. That whole booster separates, and they have another single Merlin D engine on the second stage, and that pushes these 60 satellites to orbit.
That time complete.
First stage comes down and lands on an autonomous ship. It's about as got an area about the size of a football field, and this thing comes down, opens up where it lands, and it lands vertically. And they have this gadget that comes out. It's a robotic thing that comes out and attaches to the bottom of the booster, and it floats all the way back to Cape Canaveral, standing up, don't lay it down.
Not on this particular topic, but I think it's still irrelevant. About a year ago, they discovered a hole in one of the Russian spacecrafts up there, thought somebody drilled a hole in it, and they sent it back, and it was going to be investigated. Is there any further information on that? I'm just curious.
And that was that 10-millimeter hole that they found. How did that get there, So most likely, there's never been a final confirmation on what happened. And the way the Russians are, I don't think we'll ever hear what happened. Not in the next 10 years, anyway. But, apparently, my guess is somebody was installing something in that spacecraft, and they must have missed, and they drilled a hole through the side of it. I can't believe anybody would have done that intentionally, And they were probably drilling something, missed, and thought about it. Maybe I'm going to lose my job. That's what I envisioned. I really don't know what happened, but anyway, this thing got to space with the Soyuz spacecraft. Soyuz consists of three different parts. You have the propulsion unit in the back, and then in the middle, you have the descent vehicle. That's what, your crew is. You the crew of three in that. And then the top part of this thing is the orbital unit. And, after they launch, you could float out of this very cramped descent unit and float into the orbital unit where you have a little bit more room, place to eat. You might have to spend a day or two up before you dock with the space station, although lately they're doing that much quicker, in some cases 6 hours. Let me drop it.
WB2EAV with a quick question.
And nevertheless, I'll make the story short. After they realized that they, on the way back, they didn't need that. You don't need that orbital section. Only the descent module comes back, so they weren't too worried about it. I mean, they did seal it up because they were worried about. They knew that air was going out of it. The detectors on the International Space Station detected that, and they had to find it. They found it. They plugged it, and make a long story short, they freed the crew members to get back safely. Staying with us. Go ahead. Paul WS1.
Wouldn't the classic thing to be investigated first if a hole appears hanging out in space that's a micrometeorite?
Yeah, they thought about micrometeorites initially, but after looking at it, and we had Americans looking at it, so they were flying up there at the time, and they took pictures and took, you know, more pictures than you could shake a stick at, and they evaluated it, and they knew it was a drill hole, and they knew it was drilled from the inside out. They wanted to investigate the outside of the, what it looked like on the outside as well. So the Russians did a spacewalk, you know, before they decided to come back. They did a spacewalk, and they went up with these, up there with these, they looked like, you know, hole saws, you know, sheetrock saws. And they had to take the insulation off. There was one guy's up there, and he's trying to be neat about it, and he was having a heck of a time. Next thing you know, he's ripping through the stuff, the pieces are flying all through space. I don't know. The Russian Roscosmos has a different protocol, a different procedure than NASA does, that's for sure. We would have done things, I think, a little bit neater. And he ripped the stuff apart, and they eventually got, they could see the hole, you know, and they could see that the stuff that they pushed in the epoxy, whatever it was, it had oozed out to the outside. And the Russians took pictures of it and all. And, but yeah, they know it wasn't a small meteor that hit it. Any other comments? Roscosmos right now, Dmitry, what's his last name? He's on the list, the sanction list. So in reality, we're not even supposed to be dealing with this guy, or he's not allowed into the country, and it's a big problem. So I'm glad to see that my final topic is running out of time. On 27 from Florida, 39 Falcon 9 rocket with two people, Bob Benkin, two astronauts that have gone up before. They're going on a Dragon spacecraft to the International Space Station, and we're going to be able to get away from these Russians, which is a good idea, and, you know, economically, too. And they got up to charging $85 million per seat. So, in this case, we're sending up two Americans to the space station, and it's only going to cost about $50 million a seat we pay Elon Musk $50 million. But that money will eventually be circulated, I'm sure, through all his employees. At least we know it's in the USA. And I'll be glad to see that thing launch May 27th from Launch Complex 39A, the same one that launched probably around 50 space shuttles, and all the moon launches are from Apollo. And I've gone past my 11 o'clock witching hour, so is there any last comments or questions before we turn it over to Roy? This is WS2X. No problem. Thanks for everybody listening and the questions. And, let's see, I'll be on tomorrow night. We have the Club InfoNet every Monday night at 8:30, which is always good to hear what's going on. And then lately, I don't know how long it's going to go on, we have the we're All in the Same Boat Net, and that comes on at 8 o'clock, and that's all the hints and kinks and things, stories that you could tell about the what we're doing with this